a lot of the scholars who are in the anthology and who wrote the chapters felt this sense of feeling used to an extent, in the sense that they were always subjects of studies, but never really like held authority over their narratives or their sort of the scholarship that came out of their stories and their experiences. So how does that take a different like perspective once the people that are seen as subjects are actually recognized as knowledge producers?
Welcome to InDocuTalks, bienvenidos. This is Elena and I'll be your host. This podcast is created by immigrant community for the immigrant community. We are committed to discussing important immigration topics surrounding news, culture, education, and art. InDocuTalks includes undergraduate, graduate, professors, and community collective members. Collectively, we are InDocuScholars, which we define as individuals who are conducting research, writing, documenting, producing artwork, and developing public projects from the lived experiences of being undocumented, formerly undocumented, or children of immigrants. You are listening to episode 2 of our season 4 titled, We Are Not Dreamers? You are listening to episode 2, part 2, titled, We Are Not Dreamers. At the top of our show, you heard Kathy talk about the significance of the We Are Not Dreamers book, which was centering scholarship produced by undocumented and formerly undocumented scholars. She highlights that We Are Not Dreamers flipped the script because traditionally undocumented youth were the subjects of studies, not the producers or authors conducting the research. Our scriptwriter Melissa will remind us where we left off in part 1 of episode 2. Melissa, can you break it down for us?
In part 1, we caught up with the team and hear from Elena, our very own host's experience as a DACA student and obtaining funding to attend college. Historically, the fight for in-state college funding for Dream Act students has always staggered, and many have benefited from the efforts of those that push for DACA recipients to receive support. We also hear about the way in which Elena used to call herself a dreamer and now calls herself formerly undocumented. We can tell how the rhetoric around being documented or undocumented can shift over time. Elena also discusses her work on UndocuJoy and the need for UndocuJoy to be a different form of communicating the undocumented experience, like her own experience of picking cherries, having cherry fights with her family, and then also eating tacos de frijoles. Our interviewees talk about their experiences as undocumented immigrants and their thoughts in the use of the term dreamer. They also talk about their academic and activist experiences when talking about their research that was included in the collection, We Are Not Dreamers. The three interviewees talk about their positionality, their relationship with the communities they write about, and the personal, emotional, and academic challenges and lessons that were a part of their participation in the book. So before you continue with part 2 of episode 2, go listen to part 1, which has a lot of great content, and sets up a great discussion that is continued in the second part.
Thanks, Melissa. Okay, so now that we're caught up from where we left off on part 1 of episode 2, for this episode, we're going to focus on having our guests, Grecia, Liliana, and Kathy, break down the chapters that they wrote. We'll start by listening to Grecia talk about her chapter called, I Felt Like an Embarrassment to the Undocumented Community. Undocumented students navigating academic probation and unrealistic expectations. Escuchemos.
Again, I was very involved as a student, very involved in the immigrant youth movement. And obviously, the movement was pushing for a very particular narrative of, you know, high achieving students. So I found myself in like very contradictory kind of position. I was definitely involved. I was advocating, but I was also about to be dismissed from the university. So I was like, wait, you know, I'm in higher ed, but I'm also kind of failing right now. So it really made me question that. I think was my experience when I was a student. I sometimes would see some students and never saw them again. And sometimes they would come back maybe a year or 2 years later and they, you know, they had different reasons why they had stopped going to school. So, you know, those experiences really made me question the narrative of undocumented students who have to do it all. And who have to, you know, go beyond anything academically as well. So I thought that was, it was my experience really that began to really push me to question that, right? And seeing other students and finding out that other students, you know, close friends had also struggled with academic probation. I had one really good friend of mine who, you know, casually, we were just talking like friends, joking around. And he shared that he had been dismissed from the university. I didn't know that. And he had pretended for a whole year to actually go to school because he couldn't tell his parents, right, that he had been dismissed from the university. So I can only imagine how stressful that must be to pretend for a whole year that you're going to school, but you're not, because you can. Some of those experiences and encounters with other people who sometimes defy that narrative really made me want to write about it, really made me want to talk about it. And through that process, I found that it wasn't also just about undocumented students, right? A lot of students of color, unfortunately, get dismissed, not only just on academic probation, or, you know, sometimes they're able to come back, but it's a bigger problem as well. I had other students of color who were not necessarily undocumented who began to share, you know, oh yeah, I was on academic probation, or yeah, I had a friend who was dismissed. And it was, you know, I was like, well, it's not just about undocumented students, it's a bigger problem. And it's a problem of retention as well for students. So I think that's really where, you know, I began to question that. And when I provided a story that was not in the mainstream media and that wasn't in the literature, right? Because when you look at both, it's, you only look at undocumented students, you're like, they're only doing advocacy, high achieving. And then you look at academic probation, undocumented students are non-existent in that literature as well.
Grecia's chapter focused on a topic that hadn't been discussed by either academic literature or in the mainstream media, academic probation for undocumented students. Next, we'll be listening to Liliana talk about her chapter titled Beyond Identity, Coming Out as Undocu-Queer. Escuchemos.
I gravitated more towards a rhizome as a concept, more because of the fluidity. So when we talk about intersectionality, and I know it's not how Kimberly Crenshaw meant for it to be used, but the way it's often used now is it's very simplistic, kind of reductive, like, you know, there's this road and this other road and they cross and that's it. So the rhizome allowed for that room, where a rhizome essentially is like a stem. So like ginger, when it grows, it just kind of like grows everywhere and there's really no pattern, like it just does what it wants. So essentially that's how I was trying to map out these stories of like being queer and being undocumented. These were all experiences that were happening in relation to many other things. So they weren't all exactly the same. So for me, fluidity was really important. And that's where agency came into the picture, was people were creating their own narratives all the time. People were, you know, deciding how they come out, who they come out to, if they're going to come out about the immigration status, about their sexuality in many ways and for many different reasons. And for me, the rhizome was a way to capture that agency, where maybe the structural conditions they were living at didn't allow for much room, but personally and like in understanding themselves, they were being really mindful of how they navigated those circumstances and those experiences and how they saw themselves. I believe I mentioned somewhere in my chapter about challenging this master status. So master status, this concept that a sociologist used to basically say, like, you're undocumented and you might be other things. You might be Latino, you might be whatever socioeconomic status, all these different categories, but ultimately your undocumented status is what's going to be kind of like the driving force of who you are. And so there's a lot of, you know, dialogue about that. Some people agree, some don't. I don't really see myself or my work in relation to that, mostly because that's not how undocumented people think of themselves in day-to-day lives. And I think anyone that is undocumented knows that. So trying to reflect that in scholarship, you're right, like that's why the rhizome was so important at the end. But that's the other thing that I appreciate about the concept, is that there's a lot of room for movement. This thing is constantly changing and growing in different directions. So it's never static. And in the way that this master status is conceptualized, it's very static, never changing. It's just that and nothing else. as people, even as a movement, you know, the undocumented youth movement has changed so many times, and we're continuing to change because our needs and our political context keep changing as well.
In Kathy's chapter titled Undocumented Queer Parenting, Navigating External and Internal Threats to Family, she chose to focus on families. For the first section, she defines a key concept in her chapter, spaces of vulnerability. Let's listen in to see how she uses this term.
I wanted to highlight the fact that these families definitely are going through a lot of like complex structural issues that maybe we don't see as structural, but definitely are like informed by structural systems. And it's not all negative, like they still have some agency and some like control over their lives. So the spaces of vulnerability was an attempt at sort of rethinking or like, I guess, reconfiguring vulnerability in itself. And I think you can think about it and go about it in multiple ways, but the more direct response is that came about after the interview with the eldest daughter of this family.
Kathy breaks down her chapter by focusing on the members of the family that she interviewed and their relationships.
So the case study is on one family. I only interviewed three members of that family, the father, the aunt, and the eldest daughter. The father and the aunt are both undocumented, and the father identifies as a gay man and the aunt identifies as a lesbian woman. And the eldest daughter is a DACA recipient and kind of was the one who saw all of this family dynamic unfolds, both the rupturing, but also the dad coming out and the aunt having to grapple with the reality that she's being excluded from her family once again, once the mother of the family remarried a homophobic man who explicitly was homophobic and kicked out the aunt from the family unit. So that came about when towards the end of that interview with her, where she's talking about, or I guess reflecting on her experience about the whole family dynamic and that sort of history. And she's talking about how she felt that she became closer to her father once he came out. And that seemed like an interesting thing because at that point she was already like a 20-year-old person who you would think had other opportunities to come closer to her father, but she specifically remembers and identifies the turning point in her relationship with him being once he comes out. And that's mainly because she's talking about the fact that she was in a position where she felt that as a child she had some say when he came out, because he came out to her and he was emotionally vulnerable in the sense that he was crying, but also she had control over what could happen next, in the sense that she could reject him or she could decide to work on the relationship or she could be accepting. It could have taken multiple directions, but the fact was that, because when we think about parent-child relationships, it's usually the parent has all the control, the parent makes all these decisions, and the child just follows and like does what the parent tells them to do. But in this sense, we can see that coming out in itself is a very vulnerable decision, in the sense that you can become vulnerable in a negative way, in the sense, or it can become this space where the child sees themselves as a more active member of the family rather than just a child that needs to follow like orders. So in this sense, coming out became a turning point for them because she realized that they're not equal, but they're on the same like playing field, in the sense that what she thinks and her opinions and her decisions will have an important impact on her father and what he decides to do. So the relationship became more intimate in that sense. So that's what the spaces of vulnerability sort of meant to me in that moment, in the sense that coming out is a very difficult thing to do and can have very negative experiences, but it can also become a space that you can work on and just create a more complex, maybe like understanding parent-child relationship.
The three scholars have given us a lot to think about in their breakdown of their chapters. But we want to allow some space for some dialogue amongst our UndocuTalks collective. I mean, after all, these chapters were created for generating discussion amongst our diverse communities. So Moy and Melissa, can you share some of your major takeaways from listening to our three guests talk about their chapters?
One key part that stuck out to me was when Liliana mentioned the limitations of intersectionality when talking about the lens that she used in her chapter, and how intersectionality limits the queer experiences as to how they look like and how the narratives then begin to influence dominant narratives. In the same vein, Liliana discusses that undocumented experiences in relation to scholarship are not necessarily bound together, but they constantly grow apart. They can potentially grow distant, but are never really static and are always changing. And so understanding that these statuses between the different parts of an undocumented individual's life continue to change is important to note. And I think it also takes us back into how we understand the fluidity of gender.
Yeah, I agree. I think part of what was really important about what Liliana, but also the other authors said, was about how identities, you know, are sort of fluctuate or change, right? I think a key element that all three authors talked about in relation to their chapters was how I think part of that element was what I think inspired them to write about the communities that they did write about, you know, whether they talked about academic hardships or undocumented queer communities, identities, or how, you know, some families are constructed very differently that include different immigrant and queer identities. I think that all comes from this place of challenging dominant narratives and also acknowledging that the experiences and identities of undocumented peoples are different, right? And sometimes those experiences, particularly the ones that these authors write about, are not very much discussed in the scholarship or in mainstream media.
Definitely. I think that the experiences that were shared really get you thinking about what we think about as dominant versus non-dominant narratives, as far as what aspects of gender and sexuality our listeners are open to or getting exposed to, and also then understanding all the other layers of the various experiences of the authors, but also the communities that they are writing about. It also makes me think about how these particular writers have become, in some ways, the people who have anchored these stories and now they're allowing it to be exposed to others, right? So understanding their importance of their work, even if it was in the past, is vital to how these stories keep developing and showing up in scholarship and in academia and universities. You know, it's sort of like passing on a baton, right, between a race and figuring out how to open up more space for more narratives.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the really great things about what the authors talk about is the things that they learned, you know, from these experiences of writing about these communities. You know, we asked them about their methods and the academic insight or the academic sort of things that they pulled from to write these chapters, and they talked about that, but they also were really like retrospective, you know, about what impact they think, you know, their work had on the people that they were writing about and what those folks themselves had an impact on them as authors, right, as individuals. So yeah, I think that's a really big part of this. You know, I think we expected to have a sort of academic discussion, and we ended up having more of a personal / academic sort of discussion about the chapters, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think the retrospective way that we had the interviewees look back really allowed for them to kind of open up, right, and think about their identities as academic or not, right? And I think that also changes the way that we also start to understand the work that some of these individuals are doing.
Yeah, and I think it's an element that's important, but also in a positive way can't be ignored, right? Mm-hmm. That this work is personal as well as academic.
Welcome back to episode 2, part 2, titled We Are Not Dreamers. Again, I'm your host, Elena Calderon, and we've been listening to an insightful conversation with our three guests, Grecia, Liliana, and Katy, who've been talking about their scholarship. I hope you're all feeling as inspired by this discussion as I'm feeling right now. We're winding down on our interviews with our three guests today, but we couldn't end talking about their chapters without asking the following obvious question. Who were the intended audiences for your chapter? And these are the responses we got.
Yeah, for me, I would say once I knew I was going to be able to share the work, I think for me has always been other students, other undocumented students who I really wanted the experience to be humanized. And to me, that was important and for folks to be able to relate to it. And to me, it was other students, right? Validating those students, validating other students who had a similar experience, who I could speak to, and they can see themselves as, you know, humanizing that experiences, but reminding students that you're not just you're not just your academic performance if you're undocumented, because there's so much more to us than our, you know, academic performance. And we're very complex individuals. And I think that sometimes get lost in very narrow narratives, unfortunately. So I think for me, for sure, the intended were students who had experience, whoever could relate to it. I think that was it. And I think the unintended, from what I've heard, has been other people who, you know, who other undocumented students who might not have experienced academic probation, educators, from what I've heard too. Educators have definitely mentioned that it was an important, you know, aspect to really look at that. Maybe other scholars who are writing about undocumented students and to think a little bit more broadly about those experiences, and how do we write about other experiences, right, that are not just, I don't know, reproduce some harmful narratives, why we have to be careful about that. So I think that was more of the unintended ones. But, you know, I think it's been humbling to be able to hear from folks and for them to share, you know, how it's made an impact on them, even though they were not necessarily the intended audience.
My intended audience from the start was like the people that I was interviewing, other undocumented students, other queer undocumented students. I never really thought that educators would read it because I never imagined that it would be published in this form. So I guess then the intended audience is educators. So I'm glad it's out there, that all the chapters are out there, because I think they all offer something different and equally important.
I don't think I have had many people really reach out to me about the chapter specifically. I have had folks reach out to me in terms of wanting to think about what it means to be in academia as an undocumented scholar and sort of deal with that. But the chapter itself, I don't think I've had many people reach out to me about it. But I do remember that when I presented it, like at a conference earlier on, still in under, there was somebody that came up to me and they just seemed so confused that this was an actual thing to them, because their family, like she remembers, or what from what I remember is that she said that her family had the same exact sort of experience happen to them. And when I did write this chapter, I felt like it was so unique and so particular to the specific family that it might be difficult for other people to relate with it. Because truthfully, it does like kind of read like a telenovela, like the whole family experience and like the betrayal and the separations and all of the like the reconciliation. So I was like, this seems too particular, but it's still about family. And I think that that's the main thing. Like, I think what I wanted people to see was like they can still look into their family and try to navigate these much larger issues within their own like personal family units, whatever that means to them. But I did have that one experience where somebody else came up and were like, my family has had the same experience. And that was very encouraging for me to hear, in the sense that people are relating to it, in the sense that they see themselves, they see parts of their family in it. But even for people who don't have the same experience, I still think you can relate to it, in the sense that we all have parents or parent-like figures, and we kind of all learn from them, and we can learn from them even in this sort of instance like this. And then I think another thing that I want to add about what I was saying earlier was that, and kind of feeds into the positionality aspect of it, one thing that I do think happened after the book was this sort of idea, I felt like maybe we were being romanticized in a sense of like, oh, look at these undocumented scholars, they're writing important work, And yes, I think a lot of the work in the anthology was extremely important, but I want to kind of challenge the idea of positionality in that sense, that simply because you have the same legal status or you've had an experience with the same legal status that you are an expert in it. Because like I was saying, I wasn't really trained when I was writing this chapter, and I didn't have any of like formal techniques to help me navigate with like the emotional aspect of it or any technical challenges with it. So I want to kind of challenge the idea that simply because you are of the same group or you have this sort of perspective that you are the right person to do the work, if that makes sense. And I think that that's not necessarily a new argument, and a lot of people have thought about that within different communities. But yeah, I think that that was something that did happen sort of after the book, in the sense of some level of romanticization, which was kind of ironic in the sense that we were challenging the dreamer narrative. Because at the end of the day, I think we all in one way or another benefited from that narrative.
We're back. Again, you're listening to episode 2, part 2. And just to recap, this season of Undocu Talks delves into defining Undocu scholarship. So we had to ask our guests two questions. One, do you consider yourself an Undocu scholar? And two, what does Undocu scholarship mean to you? Their responses provide new insights into this conversation.
I don't particularly use like Undocu scholar. As it's formed, just, I don't know, it just hasn't happened. I mean, I do say like I'm undocumented. I'm pretty open about my status and like my work and when I talk about my work. But I mean, I think it's great to have a space for people that are coming from a similar background, which is being undocumented, because it's a very particular lived experience. But I could also see some cautions that are like, it happens everywhere. It happens within like feminist studies, Black studies, Chicano studies. Like, it's just, there will, no one will always be in the same page that's expected. And I think one of the things that I've been really cautious about is assuming that because we're all undocumented, that we're all going to have the same politics in our writing or just, you know, as people. So that's important to just acknowledge. But I still think that it's important to have that space where, you know, there's some visibility, and at least there is a space, because like you said, I felt like it's not always been there. Yeah, those are my thoughts on it.
And for me, it's also the same. I haven't really used the term either, Undocu scholar. I realize that we are knowledge producers in a lot of different ways, which is very important, right? And you have to be cautious of a lot of, again, reproducing harmful narratives or making it seem like one, like I said, right, like the chapter might explore the experiences of 7 folks, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that's the experience for everybody else. And, you know, you have to look at different factors. But for me, I think it reminded me that we're definitely knowledge producers. We have, through our lived experiences, our organizing experiences, we're able to, you know, tell different stories. And I think that's so important to remind ourselves and highlight in our writing. But again, at the same time, reminding that everything doesn't have to revolve around being undocumented, right? Like for me, I think that's something I definitely are very interested in exploring retention issues of students of color, right? BIPOC, not necessarily just undocumented students, because I'm not just undocumented, but it's hard not to completely remove yourself from that, because it still influences me. It still impacts my everyday life in different ways, right? So I think that's an ongoing thing for me. I don't always want to just talk about being undocumented or talking about, you know, those experiences, but it's sometimes hard not to detach yourself completely, because it's part of a lived experience. So I think those are kind of, you know, I haven't really thought much about that question about the Undocu scholar specifically, but Yeah, I just want to remind folks, if you're undocumented, you're, or anyone really, through your lived experiences, you're a knowledge producer, and there are stories you can tell, there are things you can write about, and that's something that I always try to remind folks, that you can, you know, write about your own experiences.
A lot was discussed by our three guests. Next, our profs Melissa and Moy share some thoughts and close this segment out.
Yeah, I think we gained a lot of insight from hearing the authors talk about who their intended audiences were, but also when they talked about this idea of being or not being an undocumented scholar. When they talked about audiences, you know, they found it really important to highlight that the audiences that they intended for their work were the students that they were talking about, right, that they were writing about, or other undocumented audiences themselves. And one of them says that they did that in order to humanize them, you know, to validate the experiences of the people that they were writing about, you know. And then there was some unintended audiences. I think they all spoke about the unintended audiences being other scholars or educators, but that came, I think, for the most part, as like a positive surprise, you know, that educators found interest in the work that they produced and were using it to sort of have conversations, hopefully, right, that are positive and impact those students that they're talking about in positive ways. On the other hand, putting the work out there and having others read it in some ways led to romanticization of immigrant or undocumented communities, right, which Kathy mentions, because it's ironically the opposite of what the scholarship intended, right, or what they intended, particularly with the book, We Are Not Dreamers, right, of breaking down these sort of narratives and those romanticizing of an undocumented experience. And yeah, it was just sort of, you know, ironic, right, that their presentation of this work led to that a little bit as well. But perhaps that's inevitable.
Yeah, I think that we can also think about how they individually think about their purposes. So the way that they have thought about the work now in the past, right? And how that purpose has shifted and changed over time. So that the outcome of that romanticization looks a certain way. But maybe it also, if somebody out there does a dissertation on the romanticizing of the immigrant, like their journeys and their experiences in the U.S. or any other countries, we get to see like the ways that those particular narratives are, I guess, held, right, by an audience that is not undocumented or is not an immigrant. So I think there's a lot to be said about not necessarily their purpose in embarking on doing this research, but even then the purpose of the people that they worked with.
In the last segment, the authors talked about their views on calling themselves or not calling themselves undocu-scholars. What I thought was really interesting was that they all saw the existence of the term undocu-scholar as a positive, but personally didn't use it to describe themselves or their scholarship. I think it just speaks to the views on to the different views on the topic of scholarship about undocumented communities. You know, the authors talked about that their views as both scholars, but also as individuals outside of academia, right? Again, going back to this idea of it being very personal, right? The work that they're doing. And so I think they present both those views at the same time and seeing the term as a positive, but also not something that they think applies to them as individuals.
Yeah, I like this kind of response to sort of pushing back against creating a status for themselves as almost like a reclamation of, you know, here is something, a lived experience because of these colonial powers. And now I'm going to, you know, reclaim and not necessarily place this label on myself, right? And it also like just humanizes it even more, I think. While I think the term undocu-scholar or docu-scholarship is obviously very important, when we think about it in an academic sense, I think that their responses also prove how their work was, maybe at the time that they did it, obviously it was just them embarking on this journey, but then also now in retrospect, they understand the depth of the issue even more, right? And that's I think that's my take as far as hearing their interviews.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it is part of the overall theme, right? Which you put it really great that they're sort of reclaiming or just thinking about, again, what terminology even they use to describe or is used to describe themselves or the scholarship that they produce. I think, again, a really great thing that they did was come back to highlighting the fact that it's important that undocumented folks share their stories, share their experiences. One of them calls them, you know, saying like, look, you're all knowledge producers, and those experiences of the different experiences of undocumented communities are important, whether or not they're written about, right, in scholarship.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a put a little bit better than the way that I explained it. But you're right. I think there is something to be said about getting scholarship published in the case of these interviewees, and then having to move through a system that potentially pushes back, right, as far as the routes that these individual interviewees wanted to take, and then still having to sort of prove themselves through that. I think this is a great body of scholarship to check out and sort of immerse yourself if you are a scholar or not, or undocumented or not.
Okay, so getting my teacher voice activated here. Now, last episode, we assigned you to read the three chapters for our discussion today.
You just gave me flashback to my English professor, my second year of undergrad.
Okay, I'll stop. But as an engagement tool in part one of this episode, we invited you to read the three chapters that we discussed today with our three wonderful guests. And we hope that this exercise was helpful.
Oh no, are you going to assign more reading, Elena?
No, not more reading, but I do want our listeners and our community to look up two names for our next episode.
I got Google ready. Which names are they, Elena?
Awesome. Okay, so I want y'all to look up two Undocu scholars that we're featuring for episode 3, and they are Carlos Aguilar, PhD candidate in sociology at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Germán Cadenas, professor at Lehigh University, also in Pennsylvania. Okay, so you have your homework, and we'll be testing you during the next episode. We will hear from a partner who we are excited to collaborate with. Check out their ad.
Hola, we are Delitas Apparel, an immigrant and Latinx clothing brand. We're two Latinas bringing you immigrant-inspired clothing from Tongvaland, aka Los Angeles. Our clothing company aims to inspire you to celebrate and be unapologetically yourself. In our shop, you will find shirts, stickers, tote bags, and anything you can think of. Yeah. We are thrilled to partner with Undocu Talks for their season 4. We aim to collectively share our knowledge and lifestyles with our diverse communities. Stay tuned for our interview with Undocu Talks coming soon. You can follow us at Adelita's Apparel everywhere. And don't forget, stay unapologetic.
Hi there, Jackson Yahaira again, coming to you from Adelita's Apparel. We will be joining forces with Undocu Talks to grow our DACA fund to support our immigrant community. What is DACA fund? Our DACA fund started because we wanted to give back to our community. We have supported about 60 individuals with their DACA renewal funds.
And we want you, the listener of this podcast who supports immigrant rights, to help us continue to grow our DACA fund. Please visit adelitasapparel.com to make a donation today. Additionally, proceeds from the purchases from our DACA fund collection also go to our DACA fund. So get your shop on while supporting our immigrant community. Again, visit adelitasapparel.com to learn more about our DACA fund and make a donation today. Hit that donate button and help us continue to thrive as Undocu baddies.
And we're inviting you, our community, to contribute to their ongoing DACA relief fund so that you can support our community members with funds to support their DACA renewals. Thank you and gracias for listening to Undocu Talks. This culminates episode 2 with episode 3 titled Critical Consciousness, dropping on Halloween, Monday, October 31st. New episodes drop every last Monday of the month. You can find Undocu Talks on all major platforms. Remember to hit subscribe, like, share, and comment. And of course, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Undocu Talks. Our executive producer is Dr. Rafael Martinez. Our producer is Dr. Moises Santos. Our assistant producer is Froilan Orozco. Our fabulous scriptwriter is Dr. Melissa Garcia. Our Indocunus host is Alejandro Mendiaz Rivera. Again, my name is Elena Calderon, and it has been my pleasure serving as your host for this episode on Indocu Talks, La Voz de la Comunidad Inmigrante.